The Academy of St. Martin in the Fields Octet will appear on Saturday at the Dalton Center Recital Hall here in Kalamazoo as part of the Fontana series. And I am thrilled to have the principal first violinist on the line. It's very nice to make your acquaintance, Mr. Harvey D'Souza.
Hello.
I have a personal question to start with. How old are you currently?
I am 52.
How old were you when you first heard of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields?
Oh, gosh. Well, certainly in my early teens, I would say, when I first discovered the joys of recordings. And certainly that's how I learned about the Academy, through its recordings. Many, many, many moons ago. So, yes. And it stayed with me. I'm very fortunate that I'm now part of the group. But having studied in the UK and then in Philadelphia for many years and then heading back to the UK, I was fortunate enough to do an audition and get in. And so that's where I've spent most of my life.
And that was in 1993?
1993, yes.
I share with you the discovery of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields recordings with Neville Marriner conducting very early on, going through all of the Baroque concerti that I could get my hands on. I would like to hear about Sir Neville Marriner, who passed away this last December.
Yes, well, starting with that, of course, it was a terrible shock to us all. In fact, the morning of his passing, we were supposed to have rehearsal with him, and the entire orchestra was there waiting for him to arrive. And I remember, he was generally there quite early and chatting with all of us, and because we hadn't seen each other in a few months because he'd been touring with other orchestras and guesting in other orchestras. And I was looking forward to catching up with him, but there was no sign of him. And then, of course, the dreaded news arrived, immediately followed by news from his wife, Lady Marriner, who insisted that the concerts go on. That's what Neville would have wanted. But, of course, it was very difficult for us, but we did it. And, of course, the next concert we were doing with him was in the Musikverein in Vienna. So it was a pretty big deal. And that concert was probably be the most memorable concert for me because the entire audience, we were there to pay respects to him, and of course an incredible feeling of sadness. He was definitely the most sprightly 92-year-old I've ever met. He was just full of energy and always giving and always curious and wanting the best for the orchestra and best for young musicians, wanting how the profession itself would evolve, and I miss him sorely. Yes.
Do you remember him talking about why he began this chamber orchestra?
Well, yes. He, at the time before he started the ensemble, he was principal second of the London Symphony Orchestra. And it was just, I believe it was sort of during the war, and he was sort of recruited. He was a music student. And the London Symphony had lost lots of its musicians because they were sent off to war. And he was recruited as a young boy to play. And they were sort of trying to keep cultural life going in London at that time. And there he was at the deep end playing all the symphonic repertoire and learning about it in really the hardest way possible, being thrown in the deep end, not having any experience. But, yet he did it. And years of that, after a while, I think he wanted to get back to a kind of purity that was missing at that time. After the war, there were lots of performances of things like Matthew Passion or Handel's Messiah with, massive orchestras and massive choirs. And he was curious how it would have been, how it was done originally in smaller forces. because at that time, the concept of sort of original instruments hadn't, you know, it was already a big enough step to cut everything down to what they were doing, the performance practices of today. And he started this just in his living room. You know, he got a few of his friends together to start reading a lot of that Baroque repertoire that wasn't played much at the time, the Handel Concerti Grossi and Vivaldi, all the concertos, and Locatelli, and all things like that. So, and they had such a good time, so they wanted to have a concert doing this, but they had no idea how to put on a concert. But it just so happened that the harpsichordist at the time was also the harpsichordist for the St. Martin the Fields Church, that's off Trafalgar Square, London. And he managed to put on a concert. And there were lots of sort of strokes of fortune along the way, because it so happened that they, I believe, the head of Argo Records at that time happened to go to this concert and just thought this was fantastic. And then very soon they were signed up and they started making recordings. And their first tour started taking shape. And he's never looked back since. Never. So the organization certainly hasn't looked back since. So, but, you know, I guess fortune does favor the bold at times. So, you know, they at that time they were the first of the kind doing that kind of thing. So, yeah.
So interesting to hear how this famous orchestra got its name. It didn't occur to me for years to even think about why it was called Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. It just was. How does the organization support itself? Does it have a subscription series and, of course, tours?
Actually, no, we don't have a subscription. Actually, we funny enough, play very few concerts in London in the season. We tour a lot. We tour a lot in the United States and in continental Europe. And every second year we go to the Far East and Australia and places like that. So, and it's entirely supported by performing concerts. It was very interesting that originally Neville Mariner didn't want to go to the route of getting subsidy from the state, from the Arts Council and things like that, because he didn't want to have any restrictions on artistic endeavors. And of course, with that comes, you know, with funding from the state, there generally are sort of, you know, stipulations, what one must do and what one mustn't do. And he didn't want to have any of that. And he felt very strongly that the orchestra had to survive on its wits and its quality and never get into a state of comfort and ease. And, you know, he would always tell us, I remember, he said, never forget that we are only as good as our last performance. And he drilled that well into us. So, you know.
Right. Even with all the goodwill in the world from the audience who respects the name of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, as musicians, you all need to make sure that you're so well prepared and are going to give a truly memorable concert every time.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's one of his greatest talents. You know, he demanded that from us. And he picked musicians that would respond to that. So it was a two-way thing. And he also, and then he would go to the ends of the earth for his musicians. You know, that was an extraordinary, you know, extraordinary thing. I mean, there are many stories where if a musician was, you know, struggling to pay for a new instrument or an instrument that they really wanted to buy, Neville never hesitated in dipping into his pocket and never just go ahead and get it. He never ever thought twice about it. It was quite incredible. You know, he was the most generous of people, and so yeah, it was great. Yeah.
Besides having a terrific leader in Sir Neville Mariner, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields also gets to play some of the most transcendent music quite often, and you get to prepare the principal violin part for all of those concerts, many of them. Why don't we take a look at this delicious concert that you're bringing to Kalamazoo on Saturday? Yeah. Can we start with the Korngold Sextet?
Yes, which is the most absolutely wonderful piece. And this is admit to you that it's a new discovery for us. Without any reservations, I absolutely adore this piece. It's just fantastic. I mean, I love Kornigl's music anyway, but it is something that has been a fabulous journey for us, you know, the last few weeks working on this piece and getting it ready for this tour, and it's very exciting. I mean, he wrote this piece in Vienna, I believe, before he came to California, before he got involved in Hollywood and other things. But you can already hear in his in the idioms that he uses in this composition that, you know, he was destined for that. I mean, it's just so evocative, the piece itself. You know, it's quite normal in its structure. In a normal string sextet, you know, first movement in the form and in the structure of it, but the harmonies and the world and music, the sound world that he takes us through is quite extraordinary.
If you go into a concert thinking Korngold's music is going to be sappy romantic music, you'll be very surprised by
exactly
the strange turns his music can take.
Absolutely. You know, the third movement of this sextet is just, it's pure Vienna. I mean, it just has this extraordinary flavor to it that you can't be anywhere else but that. In the slow movement, for example, there are absolutely scenes you can visualize in the vast expanses of Montana or Wyoming. He it's so evocative, but with sonorities that are fantastic.
It strikes me as strange that Korngold grew up in the household of a prominent music critic who,
yes, I know,
no doubt was laying down his opinions about everything at the time.
Without question, and by all accounts, was an incredibly pushy father too. So, you know, thought his young son was the next Mozart. You know, so it must have been hard for him.
Yeah. Yeah, between a rock and a hard place for young Eric.
Yes.
Well, that will be a special treat to hear a live performance of the Korngold Sextet. That I can't remember the last time we had one performed in Kalamazoo. And again, the concert is Saturday at 7:30 at the Dalton Center Recital Hall, presented by Fontana. Details at fontanamusic.org. My guest is principal violinist Harvey D'Souza. You mentioned that the Korngold for you was fresh and new and exciting to discover. As a longtime performer in the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, you will have played the next big piece on the program, the Mendelssohn Octet, many, 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 many times.
Yes, many, many, many times. We were sort of doing an informal count recently about it, and I think I'm at about 460 performances of that piece. So, yes, many times. But the extraordinary thing about the Mendelssohn Octet, and you really can't say this with many pieces of music, but every single time we play this piece, without a doubt, there is something new in it. It's just extraordinary. This piece is a work of pure genius. This belongs somewhere. This belongs to the universe. As a 16-year-old, to write a piece like this, every single part has incredible interest in it. And the way it all comes together and the way it interweaves between other voices and is just magical. I mean, there is no question. So, and that's why it's performed so often, because you just never get tired of this piece.
Have you ever wanted to play another part in the octet?
Well, I feel very fortunate that in my short lifetime up to now, that I have performed this piece, the six different parts, except the two cello parts. I performed it on six different, so I know it pretty well. I have never performed the two cello parts. I don't play the cello, but I've done the two viola parts and all the violin parts. So, and it's just absolutely incredible, just wonderful. Even now, I carry around, and nowadays on all the different tools we have on my iPad, you can actually download the manuscript. I think it sits in the Library of Congress, but there's a facsimile of that's available to download, and to just look through it, you just cannot imagine just looking at it visually. The genius of a 16-year-old boy just penned there. I think in the entire piece, there's one measure that he scratched out. Otherwise, it's perfect. I mean, it's just everything is so precisely notated and neat, and it's a joy to see.
I'm free associating Mendelssohn and Shakespeare right now because of his Midsummer Night's Dream overture. I wonder if there's a good parallel between playing a part in the Mendelssohn Octet hundreds of times and taking on a role on stage hundreds of times like actors would do.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure there are roles like that. I mean, one that, you know, comes to my mind immediately is King Lear. And I would imagine without question that all the actors that play King Lear just find something in it every single time. First of all, it's an immensely daunting role, but, you know, there's always something to find in it because it is just such a great part. Yeah. So, yeah.
One thing we know about Felix Mendelssohn and his sister and brother is the family put such a high priority on a wide education in reading and mathematics and music and all of it. So he even knew his Shakespeare, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's look at the final piece. It doesn't look familiar to me at all. It's a Shostakovich piece.
Yes, this is another octet. It's actually just two movements. It's not very long. It's a prelude and a scherzo, again, written by a teenager. He was 19 at the time when he wrote it. Funny enough, all the octets that we're carrying on this tour were written by teenagers. And we always wonder why it is that teenagers wrote this amazing music. And probably because they had absolutely no fear, so they threw everything at it. later on they realized this is a crazy thing to do. But the Shostakovich is just these two movements of second movement is a firebrand of a movement. It's just he throws everything at it. You get a glimpse of what later on Shostakovich is going to be. But this is pre the, even in the first, in the prelude, you get a sense of the melancholy that is to come later on in his life. But even within that, in the middle, there's a almost comical section. You can imagine yourself being at a circus. It's almost like circus music that he puts. He takes us to such extremes. And the start of the last movement is just, and the second movement is just crazy. I mean, the sonorities I couldn't even begin to describe. It's just, imagine somebody tearing their hair out, and that's what you get. Literally, physically tearing their hair out, that's what you get. So, you know, we performed that before the Mendelssohn, so it's a huge contrast between having the Shostakovich and then the Mendelssohn, which is just sublime. So, yeah.
Well, finally, I would like to hear your thoughts on the profession, possibly when you became a member of this group in 1993. You were part of maybe the last group of people to find a through line of employment with a musical organization. It seems like the world has kind of been turned upside down in the decades since.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it is a pity that what is happening to certainly the arts world. It's a great shame, without question. Yes, and you're absolutely right about me personally. I feel incredibly fortunate that I sort of landed on my feet. And not just that when I joined this group, because when I joined this group, I was also part of a string quartet that you could do many different things. Now, trying just to do one thing is so hard. For young musicians particularly, it is incredibly hard. And with all the craziness that's happening in the world, if there was ever a time more important to support the arts and to be involved in the arts, is now. And you know, one of the sayings that absolutely is how shall I say it, is tattooed in my heart, is a George Bernard Shaw saying that the arts, they're not subjects that you teach at school. The arts are a reason for existence, of human existence, and I firmly believe in that. You know, we go, you know, we do our things, we do our mundane things in life, which we have to do, but when we need that moment of, you know, some spirituality, some joy, some something that releases from this, arts gives us this thing, and we need to support it the best we can. And I must say, personally, I feel incredibly fortunate in what I do, because I don't see it as a job that I do. It's not my work. It's my life. It's certainly the reason for my existence. And I couldn't imagine, you know. But, of course, I have many different interests and many other things, too. But music will always play the only biggest role in my life. So, listening to it, you know, being curious about other genres, being curious about all kinds of things, about music, about the arts, about, you know, it's fascinating. So, and most importantly, with young kids today, especially in education, it is essential that these programs are not cut from schools, because the arts give the one thing that no other subject can give. It gives an avenue of expression to children and to young people that are being taken away from them, and I think that's not fair. So I think it's really essential that we try everything to keep supporting it and, you know, and encouraging it the best we can. So
one thing that's undeniable is the talent is out there. There are amazing young people making
without question. Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you all the best on your travels with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields Octet, and we look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
Thank you very much.